Well, we welcome everyone here this morning. Immediately after the service, we're going to have baptism. We've got two young ladies that are going to be baptized, and our children's pastor, Pastor Matt, will be baptizing them. So that'll be after the service. As soon as they're ready, you can hang out in the cool weather, and all of our folks that are from Oregon and other places around the country who live here now, Wisconsin, yes, you may stay in the AC until we go outside. So they're still getting used to our normal here. We go up there, we'd be going, man, it's cold in the summertime up there. So we are excited about our baptism today and encourage you to stay around for that. We'll have it right outside. We have a portable baptistry. I want to share with you, in case you have to leave, something about that portable baptistry. When we purchased that almost 13 years ago, a lot of people thought it was kind of expensive, but it all depends on how you look at it. When we bought that, it was required to buy two more at the same time. That's why we did it. One baptistry, when we received ours, one was shipped to a chaplain in the battlefield, active battlefield, and the other one was sent to a missionary in a third world country. So the girls that will be baptized out there today, I am more than sure that probably somewhere in the world, there is a missionary baptizing someone today out of the one that we purchased here at NEC, and there's probably a chaplain somewhere out in the field baptizing someone. So that's pretty exciting to think about that and what we've invested in right there. We have my brother Rory here with us today, and his wife Flora is out in the foyer. We love our wall. Our wall has provided a place for us to do someone to interpret. We have a TV out there. They can watch the service. And Flora will be interpreting to a guest we have today from Columbia for the service. So they're out there right now at this time. Today I'm going to be interviewing my brother, and we're going to go back to the beginning of where everything started. And so, Rory, my first question to you today is, most people, there's some of us that know. I'm wearing my shirt to represent how bright and colorful it is down there, because it is. And it's way hotter there than it is here. Yes. So don't complain. It's way worse down there, and they're fixing to go back in it. Let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to Flora. Tell us where you were, what year was it, and how in the world did you meet a Mayan Indian? And where did you do that?
Oh, wow. That's one for those biography movies. So I'll start the short version. It's 1983. Our dad was a missionary, first in that village of Señor in Quintana Roo, Mexico, the heart of the Zona Maya at that time. And he challenged me to come down and spend a little time. So I did. I went down there and wound up staying a lot longer than I thought. So as I was there, with no intention of any romance, of course. You know, I was trying to be helpful to my dad. And there was this little lady that was an interpreter for my father. And she just struck me right off as different from most of the girls in the small village at that time. It was a very traditional cultural village of the Mayan culture. I noticed that she was bright and cheerful, and she had... First, she had cut her hair off. Most of the girls in the village at that time had their hair at least waist length, and they didn't cut their hair. But she had cut her hair, and she wore more like contemporary dresses instead of the Mayan traditional dresses. And as she was an interpreter for my dad, he wanted her to come in and interpret because she could go between Spanish and Mayan. And she had befriended, my sister had befriended her, Musette was her name. And she had befriended Flora, and she'd come into the house and go with us and go places with us. So, well, I got really attracted to her. You know, just that difference in that environment that I was in. So one day, I got up the courage to venture out on the other side of the pueblo, the town, the village. And I knew she lived pretty much in one general area, and so I went over there. So when I got there, it's dirt roads then, and... I got to the house that I knew that was her family home, and they were just living in palapas, if you can imagine the palapa with guano leaf roofs and poles for walls. And I began to call out, Flora, Flora, buenas, Flora. And well, her sister popped her head out That's what they do. They popped their head out and goes, Flora over there. Oh, yeah, it's the Flora. Oh, yeah, it's the Flora on the other side of the street. And I'm like, where? And so I turned around and I looked and there was this big tree. And it was it's called a ciruela tree and it grows a little fruit and it was in season. And I looked up there and there she was in that tree. And I just froze. And of course, she looks down like this, like, what in the world is he doing here? That's Don Roberto's son. Then my hair was blonde. It was not like this. It was blonde. And I stood out like you couldn't imagine in the village. But she's looking down at me, and I'm looking up at her, and I'm telling you, an epiphany happened. I did. I said, that's the one for me. Oh, I need her. That's the girl right there up in the tree. And she came down, and we walked around together, and the rest is kind of history. It moved pretty fast. Within 6 months or so, nine, we were married.
Yeah. Now, remind me if I'm wrong. I know that when I was down there the very first time, I was in a lot of palapas with large mm-hmm. families in dirt floor huts.
Yes.
And wasn't that what Flora lived
yeah,
in?
Yeah, she grew up. They're agricultural farmers, slash and burn farmers, in the reservational area lands that they're entitled to that by treaties of the government. And it's a subsistence farming, and some government program help at that time was very little. So what I'm saying is kind of poverty level. Okay, that's how they live. That's how they were living then. Electricity had just come to the village not that long ago. There was no paved roads. They were cliche roads. Most people lived in palapa homes. And maybe they'd drop one light inside the house. That was it. Dirt floors, hammocks for sleeping, and wash areas with a curtain over one side. That's it. That's how she was raised, and that's what she knew most of her life.
Now, she was one of how many siblings?
11. Actually, 12. One died when he was 2. So her mother had 12 children.
And that small palapa.
And she's in the middle.
Yeah, and that small palapa.
Oh, yeah. There was a palapa. There's usually one bigger palapa for the general family in, and then there's a second palapa for cooking. Sometimes I might build another palapa off to one side when the family gets that big where the boys might sleep and the girls will sleep in the other one.
Since you touched on it, I wasn't going to go here, but since you brought it up about the cooking area, mm-hmm. a lot of people we're used to kitchens.
Right.
It's not a kitchen, and it's a health issue too there, but it's their life.
Right.
And so there are a lot of lung issues because of the way mm-hmm. that they cooked within the palapa. Share with everybody about the life of a person growing up in a palapa.
Well, the palapa kitchen, for instance, over in one corner, you would have three big rocks. That's how the women would cook their food in one corner with three big rocks and one thick iron hot plate, where they would make the tortillas, and also a rebar hook coming down out of the hook on the ceiling on one of the poles where they would put their pots on for cooking. Well, that soot and smoke over day after day, month after month, and year after year would go up into that guano. And these palapas aren't but maybe 7 feet high. It would be black with dark soot all in the top of it. And, of course, the women making the tortillas and cooking and the fires inside that smoke billowing out and trying to find its way out of corners and maybe out of the doors, they breathe that in for years. So later in life, a lot of the women have emphysema, they have bronchitis, they have a lot of lung issues, which they're trying to deal with that now with mm-hmm. Over time came the little stoves with gas bottles. So they began, those who could afford it, those who could have it, would start to cook on with those and a little less use of fire. But it's still very popular and generally used there today.
Yeah, I still see it when I'm there. Now, the burning question is, how in the world do you go out on a date in the jungle?
You don't. You don't. You get creative. It's a walk around the plaza. There's your date. It's spending time with somebody. There's really no, at that time, there was nowhere to go. I mean, we're 25 miles from the nearest town, if you want to call it that, a municipal town where there were some stores, when there was this sort of the municipal of that area, that you'd have to go 100 miles just to get to a city in that day, which would have been, at that time, Tulum, or up north to Valladolid. There were no real places to go to do anything, really. So you just hung out in the village. Now, there was one place that was popular, and that's the Laguna that they have on the reservation, which is about 6 miles of really bad Animal Planet road to get to. But if you got there, it's beautiful. And there are certain cenotes, sinkholes, that they know about. That if you could hack your way through the trail to get to this beautiful cenote, there's your swimming pool.
Yeah.
So those
some
are some
of us
the
have been with you hacking through the jungle before.
Yeah.
There's some sitting in here today that had to do that with us.
Yeah, so. I remember things kind of cross your path if you don't look out. they get on you.
Yeah, crazy things. Let's move forward. You and Flora get married in the village, mm-hmm. have your wedding in the village. You eventually make your way to the States. Flora comes to the States. I think you had to get married like 3 times or something.
Yeah, we're very well married.
It's something like that, about 3 times.
Right.
I never forget when you brought, when I saw you and Flora showed up at the dealership, and we didn't even know she was in country. I remember that.
Yeah.
And so she's in country. She becomes an American citizen.
Right, over time, yes.
Yeah. Share with us now, you've settled in Cleburne.
Mm-hmm.
You have a home.
Yes.
Share with everybody what you were doing at the time and for a living mm-hmm. and what your life was like at that time prior to going back into the mission field. What were you doing in those days?
Well, whenever I come back, I didn't quite see God's whole plan, with our union together, Flora and I, but God would later show us. And I just set into seeking out a career. And I had met somebody who was a daughter of a police officer in Westover Hills, Fort Worth. And I was interested in that kind of work. And but I met him, and he told me, if you really want to get into something unique, he said, you need to go apply at City Center Security in downtown Fort Worth. That's the Bass Security, private security for the Bass family. I was like, what? I don't know about that. By this time, Flora and I were together, was living in Cleburne, and we were trying to get settled, and I was looking for a job like that. And so I did. I went downtown, and I applied, and God knew why he opened that door. And they accepted my application, and to make that long story short, it's quite involved in order to be accepted into a private security, paramilitary type of situation like that that guards a family like that. But I got in. I went up, started to climb that ladder. I was developing a career. I was getting a career doing that, and I wound up being our executive resident protection officer out at their residences. So I had a career I was focused on. I was going places with that. And I always gave God the glory for open doors. But as he taught me through that profession, that job, that vocation, I knew then, as I know now, that God was preparing me for something else. And so right at the very peak, I left Bass and I went to work for the Amon Carter Museum, the Carter's family. Over there, I got a chance to go over there because Robert Bass was on the board, and he wanted his top security people over there to renovate and redo the whole Amon Carter security situation. I was there with another guy I had worked with over in Bass, and he was a director at that time. So I wound up being a manager there of a security manager. And right about that time, the Lord began to turn things over in my life, about 33 years of age. So we had been here 11, 12 years. So we would go down to Zona Maya. We'd go back and I'd take my vacations, and we would go check on the work there. that my dad had started. It was still there, the small Palapa church. And so we would see her family, and we would see the pastor there, and do those things and come back, go back and forth. But by that time, about 33 years old.
Talk to us about
things changed.
The transition. You know, talk to us more about, not so much the transition, but how did you, where were you, what were you doing when you knew you received the call? And I know you need to talk about how Flora's reaction was about going back into the village after being, living in America.
Right. God began to deal with me in that last year or so at work in 95 at Naomi Carter. I was 35. And he began to say, this is not what you're going to be doing. It's interesting to see how God begins to move things in your life that you yourself cannot move, but they're moving. So he can move you into a place so you can see that call, like the song Oceans, what she was talking about, to answer this call, because this is your true destiny. I've got you to this point, and everything that you've done, I'm going to use all of that. But you're going to go back. I began to hear it in my spirit. You're going to go back. You're going to go back. That's why I put you and Flora together. Flora is part of all of this, to go back and raise that work up for my glory. And I'm like hearing this. And then I would be hearing things at work. He would just be speaking to me. And I was knew that I had to face this. And then one day in the kitchen at our house in Cleburne, that was a nice house. I was doing good. I'm still doing good. Don't get me wrong. But, living the dream right here, right? You know? And God said, that's it, yes or no. Because, I had thought in my mind, okay, we'll just do extended vacations, and we'll do the work. We'll start getting involved in the work again. We'll start doing this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he'd hear that. Then he would say, okay, then I'll tell you what, I'll get a part-time job, and I'll do it this way. No, it ain't going to work. So it's like it's all or nothing. You're going to go in all the way, and you and Flora are going back. And I'm like, okay. And I told Flora about that, and she liked, I ain't going back. See, I love my people and I love my family. I ain't going back there. What are you, nuts or something? We just got our life, all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, Flora, I don't know. God, you're going to have to work with Flora. And that was a process. I was already there. I guess those guys get there. But Flora needed some time to get there. And she did. And, of course, you remember kind of the journey that we were on at that time, as God began to place us in different ways for ministry, which eventually got confirmed by prophetic word as well, came along. And so we then got ordained in 97, December 97, to launch us out into full-time ministry in June 97. December 96, and then into full-time ministry in 97, June 97. So we've been there ever since.
Yeah, since 97. I remember you coming, talking to me about, Flora's not doing well with what I told her.
I needed to.
I remember that. Yeah. Now, you did what a lot of people don't do. You really did cut ties and go. You either sold or gave away everything you had.
You have to.
Yeah. You can't have ties like that. You hadn't been in country very long. I want you to share about that those first few months, but I want to kind of set this. I brought a team in that included Chris, who's back there, and James, and Tiffany was with us. Ralph was with us on that trip. When we arrived, I'll never forget everybody's reaction when we got in country, and then we were asking you, well, where are you living? Because you hadn't built your own place yet, so we were wondering, where were you living with two young children? And Michael was, I think, what, about?
Just a toddler.
Just a toddler. Mm-hmm. And I remember Pastor Polo taking me through his house to this little room. This little room, and here's what I saw. Roy and them had four hammocks across the room, and all their suitcases lined all the way around the room, and that's how they lived. With no air conditioning,
no
fans, just heat.
Total heat.
And so when we arrived, there were other things that happened, but talk to us a little bit about the transition from coming from all that America provides and into that little room and that first year in the Yucatan?
Well, it's like anything else. When you try to move from one place to another that's you're not accustomed to, though I was aware of, I had been there when I was younger, I had made trips down there. But to set your mind and that you're going to move into a place that is so foreign to your very nature of what you're about to experience is something only God can do for you. Because if he called you, he qualified you. You've got it in you, he'll get it out of you. And he was getting it out of me. So I could mentally adapt to this climate, to the people, to the language, to the culture, which was quite brutal. But for Flora, it was, all right, I'm back. You know, she could do it. I mean, but for me, it was a time for me to adjust to that. But I'm going to say something real quick here. Pastor Polo, which was the native pastor called to take the church when my dad left, was very small. Palapa Church, the first evangelistic full gospel to this day church ever allowed put in to be built in a Mayan reservational place like that. And it's there today. It was really big now. But he was praying. He was praying, will Don Roberto ever come back? Will you send somebody to help us? For nearly 12 years, he was praying. And then he said, will you send his son? Will you send him? Will he be the one to come and help us and partner and raise us up? Well, it was me. Tag, you're it. God also was answering his prayers, too.
Roy, let me interject, stop you before you go on about that first year. Something that folks need to understand about the village, and you said it's the only one there that's allowed to be in there.
Right.
I notice when I bring this up, people are kind of surprised and shocked. Mm-hmm. There are still chiefs in the villages and chief councils, and you have to go before them. Right. Just like the first time I went down, I was interviewed by the chief to see if I could, me and the team could stay in the village.
Right,
so
back then,
a lot of people don't understand that. So
yeah, well, they have autonomy of their own lands there. They really have their own set of laws or codes or regulations within the village. So the government doesn't really get involved with the Maya as far as how they run their towns and stuff like that, unless it has to do with the government's programs, things of that nature. So they have a lot of autonomy. So they can have, you got to have permission from the lead council people there or a mayor or the president of the village at that time or whatever in order to come in and do any evangelism at all. If you get in, you keep that favor. You must maintain that favor. But Flora was from there, so and Dad had already been down there, so there was a breakthrough. There was a breaking of the ground. But anywhere else we've ever been, you've got to watch your step because you've got to ask permission because they say what happens in their villages. And they're dotted all through the Zona Maya today, even to this day, where you have to have that kind of permission. So we're looking at a reservational situation. That's why.
Totally different. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that first year. You get in country, you're living in a little room in Pastor Polo's Palapa, and he's got all his kids living there. So share with us that first year, and you talked about for a moment about the transition you were going through. It wasn't easy. It was different for Flora, much more difficult for you, although Flora's teaching you Spanish along the way over those 13 years or so.
Yes.
But now you're on the ground. It's a whole other ball game. There's also the Mayan language.
Right.
Kind of talk to us about that first year.
Well, the first year was getting a house built, like a traditional type house, but different with some amenities to it that we needed, bathrooms, things like that. So we was able to purchase a piece of property only from her brother. I couldn't do it. Flora could. Through her name, she could purchase a piece of property outside of town at that time so we could have a place to start to build a Palapa home, our own place, so we could have a place to stay. That took almost a year or so to get that done, I think. Brother Harris, James Harris, came down there. He knows. He helped build one wall. And I want to tell a quick story. The Mayans are little people, but they're tough and fierce, and, you know, they built great pyramids and everything. And here's Big James. He's up there slinging that, you know, the trowel with all that cement and putting them blocks. And so they'd come bring us food, sacks of tortillas and food. And so they would start to eat and everything. And one of the little Mayan Mason guys in Albanil, he said, that guy, man, he really puts the tortillas away. And the other brother, a Mayan brother, goes, well, that's because his motor's bigger than yours. I never forgot that.
Yeah.
That's because his motor's bigger than yours. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's what we had to do. Was we had to get settled. We had to build this place because we knew that was going to be the central place where others would come. So that was the focus, plus relationships, plus getting the work back up, getting it started, because we already had a project to try to go from the Palapa to a material building, and God provided some ministries and to help us with that, to get that kick started, because everything you do, if God's in it, he's going to provide for it. So you've just got to take it and run with it and go and do. So that's what I started doing. And God has been doing that ever since.
Yeah, I know that you said in that first year, getting that Palapa built and getting it up was key to the growth of the ministry.
Yes.
Because you're going to need people coming in to help do things like. We came in not to minister. Though we ministered, that wasn't our focus. I brought teams in to work.
To work.
Yeah, we would work for 5 or 6 days before any of us ever spoke.
Right.
Because that's what you needed.
Yeah.
A lot of people just want to come in and we're the American, we're here to minister, we're going to speak. I'm not going to come outside the Palapa until it's time to speak. You needed people, you needed boots on the ground to get things done. And so that was the teams I was bringing in to do stuff.
For many years.
You were blessed with other churches that saw that vision. It wasn't about coming in and being the American evangelist. It was about coming in and being a true evangelist, working with the people and helping them. And fixing stuff. I know Jerry Gregg fixed some of their combies and stuff, mechanics and stuff. So you're this process is going on. Talk to us about when you knew God, you had turned the corner, and that God was getting ready to do something really special in the Zona Maya when you were there.
5 years in, usually God works in time frames like that. 5 years in, when I saw the fruit of what God was doing and what was happening, and then we were entering in some other villages further out. And they were welcome us in. And God was using this extraordinary, unusual couple for his glory as a ministry couple. Flora and I, and Flora could speak Mayan. She could communicate the gospel. Well, you know how hard that is to go from Spanish is one thing, but to take it into a native ancient language like that, Flora can do that. So God was opening doors. People were getting saved. People were getting touched. I was pouring everything I had and knew that God had put into me and the anointing of being able to communicate the gospel in that way, and saw people get saved, saw them to this day serving God, and see their children's children, third generation. When I began to see that this was the future, that God could do what he was wanting to do here, and that's 5 years in is when that, it kind of, that's it. There's no turning back. There's no stage left, exit. There's no parachute on your back where you can escape. It's like, I'm all in. Flora also had to get there, too. She thought she was all in for 5 years, and she's headed back. But God, by that time, said, no. You're going. You're going to continue to go back and minister to your people, my people. I have a work for you to do. And it's for the long term. And so at that point, 5 years in, is when we knew for sure. I mean, we're in this all the way. So
tell us, at the time you had one church in Senor. You're working and going out. I know you were taking teams out. I remember when our teenagers came in, Tiffany and them kind of kick-started the teenagers getting involved and doing, little skits and plays.
Yes.
And they saw that. Tiffany put all that together, and they saw that.
Really new for them.
Yeah, and they were like, we're going to do that. So you started taking the Mayan teens to other villages and deeper in the jungle.
They started
doing
the same thing they saw them doing, which is amazing. Because the Mayans at that time were very shy. They're kind of shy, inward people. They don't really like outsiders at that time. And so they would bring in these teams, and they would do their plays and things like that. They thought that was so cool. So they began to get encouraged to do that too. So it developed over the years that they began to, we had our own teams and we could take them out into the villages and they would minister to their own people that way, which is, whoa, that was very new.
I know that you began to develop, and I know it's still going because you talked to me about when you get back, mm-hmm. you're just running from the time you hit the ground.
Right.
One of the things that came out of that beginning, if I remember correctly, was the fact that you started doing children's events in mm-hmm. different villages and in the jungles mm-hmm. way back in some of the places.
Because they didn't do anything like that.
They didn't do anything. So you were doing children's events, youth events, something that had never happened before.
Right.
And y'all would go in and sometimes be gone for a week or two
yeah.
doing these things and taking these kids mm-hmm. with you into some pretty rough environments mm-hmm. and doing all that. And that's something you're still continuing today.
Still continuing, and we're still seeing great, great results. The kids show up for these events. We call them vacation Bible school or kids camps and things of that nature. But back then, in those days, nobody ever came to that in those villages farther out. And when we do that, we'd get up to 100, 150, 200 kids. And we would also feed them. You know, we still do that today. It's not cookies and Kool-Aid. Some of them, it's a meal because they come and stay most of the day, and we teach them and have entertainment, have all those kind of things you would do in a VBS, but way further out than that because we also feed them. And so many of these kids come from situations where, well, you can use your own imagination, where they are just excited to have our VBS. Now, it's a big, big thing, and it's a blessing to be able to continue that today. And when we get back, we're going to have one for 4 or 5 days in August. So we usually run 100 kids or more. And we open it up to the whole village, to the whole town.
You have these things. Mm-hmm. You have the one church. You're starting to go out and do the children's ministries. You're doing youth ministries. I know that you were being very strategic about and trying to connect with different pastors,
mm-hmm.
not only just Mayan people to raise up as pastors, but also there's a lot of mixed culture where we have a Mexican Mayan
mm-hmm.
Like Pedro, mm-hmm. and you have other, and you're making all these connections, and it's beginning to kind of grow. Just kind of where are you today? How many churches and ministries roughly that you're connected with, and you've raised up a lot of churches too, and pastors that didn't even know they were called till you showed up.
Man. Yeah, because that's part of the apostolics, calling out callings, okay, and identifying them and saying you're called in the hands of people and watch them go. Up to 7 churches that we're directly connected to, 7 and 2 missions right now, and they're all prospering and flourishing right now. We thank the Lord for that. Thank you, Jesus. Yes, and all of you are part of it. That right now is so exciting to see that. As I mentioned before, when you can see the mothers and fathers get saved, then their kids are maybe little to teenage or whatever, and they get saved. You know that because you're there. You're on site. You see it. So you see them get saved, and then their kids are now walking in the light. And then as we began to grow, people began to hear about us. Other churches like the prophecy churches, assemblies, other things like that, other churches and others all over the Yucatan, we began to go out and we'd go and minister. We've ministered all over the Yucatan and held many, many, many meetings with different pastors that we're in relationship with and that raised up and grew churches through that relationships.
Yeah,
it's
radically
fast.
Changed since I first started coming.
Mm-hmm.
And with teams, we don't bring teams anymore. But, I mean, the last time Gary and I were there, we were only in Senor, I think, 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we rode in every kind of vehicle you can think of. And our kidneys were talking to us.
Yeah, they
get
shook around.
Yeah, we got shook a lot.
Yeah.
Traveled all over the Yucatan. And the last word I got from you this last time was that we were going to be doing more traveling next time.
Yes.
Because there's more stuff going on.
Oh, further out, way out.
Yeah, way out. And there's more opportunities mm-hmm. and stuff. So everything is changing.
Right.
I'm going to use this word. We use the word global a lot, but in a way, it's like the zone of my ministry that God's called y'all to is now becoming global within the mm-hmm. whole Yucatan,
right.
from coast to coast mm-hmm. and border to border. That would be a true statement at this time, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, all yeah. 3 states make up the Yucatan Peninsula, Campeche, Yucatan, and Quintana Roo. We've ministered in a lot of churches all over all 3 state areas and in meetings and in meetings held in the street, even in basketball courts. Everywhere you can imagine, we've had meetings. And it's what's exciting is to see all the fruit of those meetings, too. People yeah. set free, people saved, people delivered. Healings, oh my goodness, tremendous amount of healings that God has done. And just saying, I'll go, we'll go, we'll go, we'll go as a team, we'll go out, we'll make relationships, we'll keep those relationships, we'll let them grow. And that's where we are today with these works that we've all been involved in, and which you've been involved in, even up in Cancun with Brother Gaspar, all over, another brother, Manuel Colt, over in Merida. Oh, I could just go on and on. Of all the places we've been and all the ministries. Chris has been with us many, many times, all through these areas, ministering the Word of God. And it's been exciting. Let's see what God's doing in the heart of the Zona Maya.
Tell us about the moment you heard that you had made the real breakthrough as the American in the Yucatan when the governor called you the White Mayan.
Oh, yeah, there was an official. I don't know, he's pretty high up. You figure, well, I've been there so long, living among the Maya. And how did come? How is that even possible? They haven't kicked him out of there. You know, that's what happens. You know, after a while, it's like, okay, you're done. How do you, you know, what are you doing? No, God set us in there. He set me in there. And with the favor of the people through the many years. So they began to call me the White Mayan. The guy, the white guy that lives among the Mayas. I mean, it's all the way up. They know about me. But the thing is, as a missionary, as a man of God, with one purpose in mind is to bring people to Christ in every form and fashion that Christ gave to us, the full gospel of his truth, into people, is stay out of the politics. I'm not down there to start businesses and run for office. With that, you have their favor. Because I'm there for one thing only four and nine, and that's to touch people's lives with the gospel as a minister. There are certain things you learn when you're in another culture, what you do and what you don't do. And one of the things you also do is that you can't pretend that you love them. Okay? If you're called to a people, you have to love them in all the good and all the bad. And God called me to love the Mayan people. And that was one thing about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, they had a meeting in the town of Senor. It's a meeting. It's called a meeting of all the lead families and leaders. There were people coming into the town that weren't from, they weren't Mayan. They either intermarried with others from other parts of Mexico, their sons and daughters, and tried to come in and move in. And they were causing issues because they weren't respecting the traditions of the people or respecting their language, things like that. So they called a big meeting, and so I was called in after these many years and be in there to be judged whether or not I could stay or whether I would be let, I would be told to get out of town, get out. And the government will respect that. They say, you've got to leave. But I was the one guy that whenever they asked me to speak in front of 350 Mayans in one place about this big with two little windows out this side, and you're in there cooking. Oh, it's so hot. And I got up there and I said, I came here for one purpose only. You remember my father. I am here with my wife and we're here to preach the gospel. And then I love the people. That's why I'm here. And I got an applause. That was amazing. Not one hand went up to say out. And after all that time, and I said, God, you did that because they kicked six others out. Then they were from Mexico. They're nationals. But they have say who lives among them. They have say who's going to be there. If you're going to rock the boat the way they don't want you, you don't need to be here. But my goal was to focus on the call and what God sent us there to do and with my wife. And we see the result of that today.
Yeah.
That just shows where God's favor is. It doesn't mean that everybody there, you know, likes you, agrees with everything you're doing and all of that, but it's maintaining your integrity, maintaining who you say you are and how you still are who you said you'd be.
Yeah.
And that's why we're still flourishing there.
With the little time we have left, would you give us a brief report? The church, North Elevation Church, has helped Pastor Robert with, when we first got there, still can't get out of my mind. We show up to this little church palapa, and the sound system, John, is in the weather. Soundboard and everything's got sand and dirt on it, and and Gary and I were like, we got to do something about this. And give us a brief report on Robert, where that's at today, and then Pastor Pedro, who was here, spoke, greeted everybody. There in Merida, when we first went, there was no roof. He was barely getting the walls up. He had no floor. When we started helping with that church, building that church, and we know that because we were helping build churches in the Yucatan, God gave us a place during COVID.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Whatever goes on down there is coming back to you.
Yeah, God honored that. So give us a report on those two.
Well, those the church in Roberts in Campo Coches, what it's called, the name of the village, is really progressing. It's about the roof's about half done already. We already got the platform, the walls, everything. We have to start the floor. So it's a big church, right, for there. And so it's ready to make another advance this year. But about 45% of what's standing there right now has come from this church.
Yeah.
From here and from individuals of this church. I thank God for that.
Yeah. And then, this is back in the jungle.
Oh, yeah.
Robert's
well,
back in the jungle.
Yeah, thank God for that paved road they finally got down there.
Yeah. Then Pedro.
Pedro over on the other side of the Yucatan is also, we're coming along with that one, too. In fact, I want to announce that we're going to advance another part of that church. The back wall is going to go up, and the platform is going to be finished. They already had meetings there this last 2 days.
Oh, good.
I already had meetings with our other pastors from Gusama, and Valdolid and these other towns all met together in these last 2 days. I wish we could have been there. But we watched them live last night, and I talked to them by text. But they're excited about us coming back real soon. So those churches are advancing.
Awesome.
So with their projects.
In 60 seconds, share with everybody a word that you believe God is speaking to you for NEC this morning, and just release that, however long that.
Well, I hear it right now. Stay the course. Stay the course and hold the vision. I know you've written it down. If you haven't, you should. You should see it. You should see it clearly, as I did in that kitchen that day. There's no turning back. It's only going forward, because everything we have is in front of us, not in back of us. God is a forward. It's always forward. It's always going forward. So that's the word for NEC, is to go forward, keep going, keep reaching out, keep opening up so others can come in and go out and share the gospel and your testimony and your faith with others. That's it. That's it in a nutshell. And I thank you for the. I thank God for this church, and I thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you for sharing with us and allowing me to interview you today. I do want to remind everybody, we are having water baptism after the service, so hang around if you can. I do want to, Rachel's fixing to come up, but I do want to share with you that Flora's sister passed away while they were
Flora's brother's wife
passed away while they were here, and they're not going to be able to get back for the funeral because down there you have to bury folks very, very quickly. So be in prayer for Flora and the family. As they'll be journeying back down there with all this that's going on.
Super quick, as Flora is a dynamo, she's the Ruth. She's my Deborah under the palm tree. She is something else. She is known among her people. God works through her in a mighty, mighty way. The little lady back there, the one I saw up in the tree. Yeah. That came my wife. Mm-hmm. Amen.
That's always amazing. Yeah, Roy and Flora will be in the foyer, so you can speak to them after church. Rachel?